here and speak into the microphone.
And not everybody at once. Oh, Garrett's coming to answer your questions. Garrett wants to answer the questions.
J.D. Unwin in Sex and Culture says, when a culture crosses over into unchastity with sexuality, then it's crossed over to destruction. So what do we do if we're living in that time we've crossed over in that, and the church is this alternate institution? How do you prepare for the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So J.D. Unwin, and to my knowledge, he was not a Christian. He was at Oxford or Cambridge, someplace like that. Years ago, sometime in the 20th century, did a massive study of every civilization that he could find a record of. And what he found, basically, is that civilizations that practiced some form of sexual chastity and that emphasized marriage and all that came with it, those civilizations thrived. But every civilization eventually, the patriarchy collapsed, that sexual ethic collapsed. And when the civilization gave itself over to sexual immorality and licentiousness, it was only a few generations before that civilization completely collapsed. And so the question would be, well, what does that mean for us? The sexual revolution started, say a couple generations ago, and since then we've seen the downward spiral that our culture, our civilization has entered into. And so what does that mean for us? Do we just kind of stand by and watch civilization fall apart and, wait around to pick up the pieces? It may be that is about all we can do in some ways, because as Christians don't have a lot of cultural power right at the moment. We don't have a lot of cultural influence. But I still think there are a lot of things we can do. The number one thing I would say we should do is focus on building up our churches as certainly communities of faith. That's always central, but also communities of virtue that will have the strength to actually be countercultural. If we are entering into what might be a sort of modern equivalent of Israel being carried off into exile, when the Israelites basically became slaves because, God sent invaders to conquer them and carry them away. If God is doing the same thing with us, maybe without the, without the geographical movement, but still relegating us to a position of, say, slavery within the culture where we have cultural masters or overlords who are, basically making it very difficult for us to live out our faith, what do we do? Well, I think the number one thing we have to do is make sure that our own house is in order. And that starts with the church, and then that's got to spill over into our households. So let's make sure that, that our wives and children, that our families are being faithful to God, that we're training our kids in these kinds of truths and these kinds of very practical skills and virtues. And let's make sure that our churches are strong and healthy with really strong community, where we look out for one another, where we've got one another's back, where, your pastor gets thrown in jail for saying that homosexuality is a sin, and so you're ready to go visit him and take care of his family while he's locked up. Or you've got somebody in your church who practices medicine and he's being forced to be party to a transgender surgery or to an abortion and he won't do it. And so the hospital fires him. And so now somebody who was making a pretty decent living for himself finds himself unemployed and maybe unemployable. Well, now what? Well, you got to be able to look out for one another in those kinds of situations. Those kinds of things may happen, they may not, but I would say we'd be foolish to not at least think about the possibility and plan for them. Maybe we need to be saving up a lot of money in our deacons' funds and that kind of thing to help one another when the government comes after our business. Or think about this. You got a photographer in your church, and he's asked to photograph a same-sex wedding to glorify this event with his photography skills, and he won't do it. And so he gets sued. Now he owes $200,000. Okay, well, where's that money going to come from? It's going to bankrupt him. What's going to happen? I think we got to be there to make sure we're looking out for one another and we can really help one another. So I think we've got to do that. I think we've also got to keep teaching and preaching this message, because here's the thing. Our culture is in rebellion, and that rebellion is already bearing some really bad fruit. One of my graduate school professors, Jay Buszewski, he was. It's one of these stories where he was basically a communist. He was a Marxist and then became a Christian and now is a very outspoken Christian. and has done a lot of work. He's a political philosopher. But he says that back in the 80s, when he would talk to the students, basically about sexual issues, that they kind of all thought that things were going okay, that their fornication, the hookup culture, they were not experiencing the worst fruit of that. But he said a few years back, he said, now when I talk to students, he's like, they know there's something wrong. They can see the terrible fruit this is bearing and how destructive it is. And they're actually open to thinking about things in another way. And so when people in our culture start to realize, you know what, this isn't working, let's be there with the answers. Let's be the one who can point to our families and point to our Bibles and say, look, this is how it should be. This is how we were made to live. This is the good life. This is how we were designed to live. I think we've got to be doing things like that. We've got to be ready to do things like that and hope that God will give us success. If you go back and you look at England before the First Great Awakening, it was very dissolute. This is early 18th century, and it was really in bad shape. Widespread drunkenness on a scale that even goes beyond our drug abuse problem. There were brothels all over the city of London, just widespread moral corruption. And it looked like it would really be the end for England. But what happened? God raised up a John Wesley. He raised up a George Whitfield. He raised up a number of great pastors and teachers in the church. And the nation really did undergo revival. And it really was transformed. And you can look at England now and say, well, they need that to happen again. Yeah, sure. But really, England was put back on track as a nation with public virtue, for another 100 years plus because of the Great Awakening. Well, let's pray that God would give us a Great Awakening, and let's pray that God raises up men like that, men who can herald that message and make something happen. I don't think we ought to just give up or surrender. I think we ought to keep fighting and fighting in whatever avenues or channels God gives to us, whether that's in politics or in the arts and media or just in relationships we have with neighbors and our own families and churches. I think those are things we ought to be doing. Gary, did you have other things in mind? Maybe you could add to that.
No, pretty much what you said. I mean, our we live in a culture that doesn't want to hear us preaching to it with words. And one of the strongest apologetics we have with all this cultural stuff is modeling good family life.
Yeah, that's right.
And how it should be.
Yeah, I agree.
Could you touch on the importance of masculinity and sexual purity, especially for our young adults and even men that aren't married, just the necessity in order to maintain that aspect of life?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you look at Proverbs, and it's hugely important in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs puts a huge emphasis on sexual purity for the young man. Because if he's not sexually pure, first of all, there's something effeminate about that. A man who falls into sexual sin, he's failed to be a man who's got self-discipline and self-control. So there's that element to it. But I think weak men like that are easily controlled. I mean, this is one reason why I think our government has no interest in promoting any kind of sexual virtue, because men who are not virtuous are pawns that the state can do with as they wish. Guilty men are weak men. Ashamed men are weak men. And so they can easily be pushed around, and they, again, become pawns of the state very easily. So if you want to be a strong man and you want to manifest real masculinity, you have to be disciplined, and you have to be disciplined in this area. I used David and Solomon as models of masculinity, but look, what was their weakness? For both of them, it was women. And so let that be a lesson. And both David and Solomon were rendered ineffective in a lot of ways. I mean, they obviously did great things, but they were also rendered very ineffective, and they made their own family lives a complete disaster because they fell into sexual sin. So you've got lessons there. You've got object lessons of, if you sin in this area, it is going to have all kinds of complications and consequences that are going to be very, very difficult to deal with. Downstream consequences are going to really, really be harmful. So I think men have got to make sexual purity a priority. And that's why in my second talk last night, I really, really emphasized this. It's not enough to say that the Bible forbids premarital sex and adultery. Today, we've really got to make a case for those things and explain why that is the case. You've got to do the same with pornography and other forms of sexual sin and be able to say, look, these things are incredibly destructive. They're just incredibly destructive. So you need to see them as poison. You need to see them as poison, and you need to do everything you can to protect yourself from them. Does that help? All right. What else?
I think we all understand the dangers of technology, particularly the way that smartphones and those kind of things are. How do we take into consideration technology with regard to intersexual dynamics?
I think accountability, flee immorality, would be a big part of it. And I think parents have got to play a huge role in this. In terms of monitoring, it's very hard to do. We were kind of the first parents with the age that our kids are. They were sort of the first to have smartphones when they got in their teenage years. Okay, so like, here's one thing to think about. For boys and girls, there's been an explosion in teenage depression since 2010. Okay, so, the depression levels for boys and girls, teenage boys and girls, are kind of going like this, and then you get to 2010, and for both sexes, it just takes off like that. Well, what happened in 2010 that would suddenly change that? Well, let's see, your Instagram comes out, okay? That's when everybody starts to have one of these in their pockets. And while I mean, the technology itself is good, there are lots of things about the technology to be thankful for. We can use it in all kinds of good ways. The technology also is very, very dangerous. And I think it's very hard for parents to always monitor how it's used. I mean, you've got to educate yourself as a parent to know kind of what's out there. But I think accountability is tremendously important. I think that, teaching your kids constantly about these things, about the dangers of what is available. I mean, we could think about, ancient Corinth, okay, where there was a prostitute, down at the temple, 24/7 available. We've got something far more insidious, really, in a way, right there on your phone. It can be incredibly destructive and addictive. Now we've got all kinds of studies, that show us how much pornography rewires the brain. It's like doing heroin. It's addictive, and once it gets its hook in you, it's really hard to get it out. Think of pornography as Satan's Bible. God's got his Bible, and Satan's got his, and it's pornography. And you've got to do all you can to avoid it. And it's a problem, certainly a problem for boys, because they're sexually interested, sexually curious, and have, sex drives that are very strong that they don't even know what to do with when they first hit puberty. But it's becoming more and more of a problem for young women as well. And they are sort of taking their cues about what they should be like from pornography as well now. And it's making, young girls very sexually aggressive and, much more immodest and all those kinds of things. So we got to be super, super careful. I mean, I think... I saw something the other day, and it was, the Screwtape letters from, a senior demon to a junior demon. And I saw a little meme the other day, and it just said one thing. It was the advice from one demon to another. It said, invent Instagram, yours truly, Wormwood. I mean, it's just like that, these things become so easily corrupting influences in our lives. And I think can so vitiate about intersexual dynamics, so corrupt that whole relationship between men and women. I mean, think about it. So guys now, it's not just that they can go, look at any supermodel, online, but they can actually see girls that they're in class with 5 days a week in bikini pictures on Instagram. Okay, well, how healthy is that for him to have those images in his mind when he walks into class with her on a Monday morning? Okay? And what happens to her, she realizes if she puts these Instagram, pictures up there of her, dressed very immodestly, well, then she get lots of likes and lots of oh, you look so amazing kind of comments. And so her sense of her, of who she is, I mean, in one sense, it goes through the roof because she's getting this hit of dopamine from all these likes and everything else she's getting on Instagram, but also gives her a really false sense of where her value is found and what her value actually is. So it just has an incredibly destructive impact on both men and women. If there was some way to keep teenagers off of Instagram and maybe social media in general, I would say to do it. I just know that's really, really hard, unless you go live in a cave somewhere. It's just really, really hard. So I think the challenge is there for parents, but it's a very difficult thing.
Yeah,
Did you have something else in mind? I mean, I just kind of talked there,
well,
just
no,
off
I
the cuff.
I appreciate all that. I was also wondering if even the nature of the medium is doing something. I mean, there have been studies, obviously, the more we're social gnostically via
device, yeah.
the less we are able to be social, be masculine and feminine.
Absolutely.
Pursue, you know, it's very easy to be a boy and a girl today in some ways, as far as not having to do hard things, have awkward conversations, ask someone to for their number or whatever it is. Even,
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it's hard to imagine John Wayne with a smartphone, with his thumbs typing away. I just can't picture it, you know. I would say, you know, to young men, I mean, don't chicken out and use text. Go talk to a girl face to face, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it used to be, you know, like when I was growing up, if you wanted to talk to a girl, say over the phone, you have to, you know, call her number and then probably talk to her mom or dad who answered the phone for a few minutes first. I mean, there's something, you know, so privatized about our ways of communication now that, like you're saying, I mean, it takes parents out of it. It takes the face-to-face element out of it. There's just a lot of things about it that are problematic. Again, I'm not saying the technology itself is evil, but this is unprecedented in a lot of ways in terms of the possibilities of it, and it really can be destructive. It really can be damaging.
I think sometimes it even
this is good. I'm
sorry.
Yeah, please do.
I think we don't even realize how it touches, whether it's intersexual or even just societal, the fact that we create group chats or we have communities so for young people who don't partake in that, they're completely and fully ostracized and they almost live in a different society. And that happens, I think, and like you said, that also then integrates. There's no parents paying attention to anything that boys are saying to girls.
Right.
And vice versa.
Yeah, parental oversight is a nightmare. I mean, it's always been tough, but now it's especially a nightmare. Okay, you had a question.
I'm going to ask two.
Yeah, okay.
So first, what would you say, like in your own studies of feminism things, what was the cultural shift that, like, I guess, caused first wave feminism? Because I've heard a lot of like defenses of feminism saying that there's obviously like some cultural problem that it's trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think that was? And then an unrelated question would be, with the proper views of like masculinity and femininity, what would you advise dating to look like?
Yeah, those are two really good questions. The question about the origins of feminism are really interesting. And I mean, you ask a great, great question. I'm not sure I've ever come across a really satisfying answer. I mean, I've seen a lot of conjecture as to sort of what drove this. Was it women who were unhappy in their marriages? Was it women who, as the economy was changing, who wanted to participate in sort of the new economy after the Industrial Revolution? I mean, the Industrial Revolution really did change our lives. And one thing it did is it gutted the household. A lot of functions that used to be performed by the household were taken out of the household after the Industrial Revolution. So, you think about this, in a pre-Industrial Revolution household, most people are, agrarian, most people are farmers of some sort, they're providing largely for themselves. And so, the whole economy, the whole household economy, it all just flows right through. It flows to the house itself in a very kind of physical, practical kind of way. And there's a division of labor in terms of the man and the woman, but they're working alongside one another in the fields or in the house. And so, the home is the place of education. It's the center of health care. It's the place where whatever business you have, you do it basically out of your house. So the house is very productive. And what happens after the Industrial Revolution is homes that were places of production start to become places exclusively of consumption. Now we don't do anything in our homes other than rest. It's Netflix, which we don't produce ourselves. We just passively receive it. It's that kind of thing. We don't produce anything in our homes anymore. And as this shift was taking place, one theory as to where feminism sort of why it arose is that the household was not playing all the same functions. And so, women grew discontent, just feeling like they weren't valued or needed as much as they had been, since now, education gets farmed out, healthcare gets farmed out, businesses get separated from the household and that kind of thing. And so you know, with the urbanization that came with that, of course, the household looked very different. So there are a lot of people who have speculated that. And I do think that we should not underestimate the impact of economic forces, changes in economic conditions and that kind of thing that put pressure on certain ways that then make these kinds of movements happen. I mean, there's no question we've even seen that, you know, in the last 50 or 60 years as so much of our manufacturing has gone away. If you ask what's happened to a lot of, you know, say, Rust Belt towns, you know, over the last couple generations, why is there so much opioid addiction in these towns? Why is there so much suicide and social breakdown? You know, why is there so little social capital in these places that were once thriving towns? I mean, we can talk about it spiritually, how that happened, but I think we also have to talk about it economically. I mean, you take away the jobs and the manufacturing, and a lot of things do collapse. And I think something similar happened for the household, and I think that's part of where feminism came from. But I also think that it's Genesis 3:16. It's the battle of the sexes. It's sin, and it took a particular the rebellion took a particular form, especially in kind of the mid 19th century, and it just kind of snowballed. And caught on. And I think a lot of women who are discontent with, you know, this or that aspect of their lives sort of gravitated towards it. And that's even when you start to kind of have this view that men are scum and women are angelic. I mean, prohibition was a movement led almost entirely by women. And the idea is, you know, men have got all these vices, you know, drunkenness and gambling and these kinds of, and the way that we can stop all that is by making alcohol illegal. So it was a very, you know, feminized kind of thing that it's largely accomplished by women who are trying to straighten out society. He sort of took it upon themselves to do this. And I'm not saying those problems weren't real. I mean, they were obviously addressing a real problem that a lot of men had. But the fact is, prohibition obviously was not successful. But, men cannot be led into manhood by women. And that's one of the reasons why nagging doesn't work. I mean, a man may know he's not a very good leader, but his wife nagging him, he still knows enough. He's still man enough to know he can't be led into manhood by her. And so it's not going to work. And I think the same kind of thing is going on with feminism. Another way to think about feminism is to think about it as a test for men. You know, there's this well-known psychological dynamic, and Christians have noticed this. Non-Christian psychologists and sociologists have noted it, that women test men. Like when a couple first kind of starts dating, and I'll come to your dating question in a minute, but a lot of times a woman will maybe push back on a guy and be a little bit disagreeable with him, or maybe even a little bit disrespectful. And in a way, she's just trying to test him and see what he's made of. Does this guy have the backbone to stand up to me? Because if he can't stand up to me, he's not going to be able to stand up to anybody. And so how can I trust this guy? And really, this goes back to Genesis chapter 3 as well. When Eve offered the fruit to Adam, it, in a way, was a test. And you know, God points this out when he comes to the man and he says, because you listened to your wife. Okay, she was testing him and he failed it. You know, he what was Adam supposed to do in the garden? He was supposed to protect her. He was supposed to guard the garden. He should have crushed the head of the serpent. Okay, should have protected her in this way. He failed that test, and women have been anxious about men ever since. Will this man protect me or will he abandon me? Will he be like the first Adam in the garden who left me to face the serpent on my own? Or will he be like the second Adam who put himself between me and the serpent, who took care of me, protected me, guarded me, fought the enemy for me, fought the dragon, you know, the serpent for me? So women will test men. And this will happen in relationships, you know, where women can do it intentionally and disrespectfully. I think they can also do it in respectful and even non-intentional ways, but women will test men. And they, again, want to see what that man's made of, whether or not he's got backbone. Okay. And, you know, a man who just caves in and always gives the woman what she wants and only tries to keep her happy and can never tell her no. I mean, in a sense, he's communicating to her that he doesn't have any grit or determination of his own. He's easy to control. And that's just going to make her more anxious. 1 Peter chapter 3 describes the woman as the weaker vessel, which means the man is the stronger vessel. Okay, there's a stronger vessel and a weaker vessel. Well, a man who becomes weak, now the marriage has got two weaker vessels. And that just creates more anxiety for her. I mean, again, all women, going back to Genesis 3, are going to be anxious about the man. They're going to be anxious, you know, will this man be a good head, a faithful head, a strong head? Will he get things done and take care of things? And when he's not, or if he shows any signs of weakness, you know, she'll, again, kind of probe and test for where those signs of weakness may be. You know, if it turns out he's weak, that's just going to increase her anxiety and her insecurity. I think feminism was basically a civilization-wide test of men that men have miserably failed. Women pushed back against men and basically said, are you really going to lead us or not? And men caved in and said, well, no, really, we're not. You know, we're happy to abdicate and let you take charge and do your own thing. And it's been a disaster. I've sometimes speculated, and that's all this is speculation. You know, what's this odd alliance that you have between, you know, sort of liberal, progressive feminists in American politics and Islam? Why? Those are strange bedfellows. Why is there that connection that you sometimes see in our politics? I wonder if at some level it's because those feminists are sick of Western men who are weak, effeminate, beta males, and actually find something compelling, intriguing, and attractive about Muslim men who are alpha males. And, I mean, they're not very good men, obviously, but they're manly in ways that Western men are not, and I've wondered that. So, I mean, that's another way to think about feminism. It's kind of a civilization-wide test of men that men have failed miserably. We've all too easily abdicated and sort of given women what they wanted. Men should have stood up and said, no, you're not going to do that. You know, we're just not going to have that. This is what God says about your role. This is what we're going to do, and we're going to figure out how to make it work. You know, trust me in this. But instead, men just caved. The question about dating is a really good one. I don't know that I have a great answer to that because, I mean, again, it can vary so much from sort of place to place and culture to culture. We're probably a lot of us are familiar with the writings that have been done on courtship and courtship versus dating and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of things about a sort of a court, you know, an old fashioned courtship model that's really attractive because it seems to provide those needed safeguards and accountability for young people when they're pairing up. At the same time, I really haven't seen it work that well with families that have tried it. And I think Doug Wilson is on to something when he says, you know, the difference between dating and courtship is that you've got four idiots involved instead of just two. Because you now got the parents involved, you know, or maybe six idiots if both sets of parents are involved. So, I think sometimes kind of a courtship model puts a little too much pressure on the relationship. Oh, you guys went on a first date. Well, when are you getting married? You know, kind of thing. And that's not good. I think what I would say is this. This is what I would recommend. In our Christian, you know, conservative circles, I think we ought to create lots of opportunities for young guys and girls to get together and have dances and have social interaction and build the beginnings of relationships with each other where you can get, you know, guys can get used to being around girls and talking with girls and figuring out which of the girls they might like and girls doing the same, and provide lots of opportunities like that in settings where there's a group and there's accountability, and then as they get older, as they get to the right age where marriage could be in view, you know, before too long, they can kind of start to pair off and they can actually go on dates. And again, I think that it makes a lot of sense to have accountability with those dates and that kind of thing. But I do think that, there's also something, you know, healthy about that so long as it's done in the right kind of way. I mean, obviously, the way dating takes place in the world where there's the expectation of, you know, of some level of sexual intimacy and that kind of thing, I mean, that we've got to reject altogether. So that's always the fine line you balance, is how do you get guys and girls together while also helping them or keeping them from, you know, falling into sin, the temptations that come with it. But right now, the way things are, you know, with the marriage rate as low as it is and that kind of thing, it's becoming more of an urgent problem. We have to find ways to get guys and girls together to pair them up. And so I think, you know, lots of teaching on this, lots of teaching on the goodness of marriage and the beauty of marriage, not just how hard marriage is, though it is hard. But lots of teaching on the glories and the joys of it. And then, you know, finding those opportunities for guys and girls to come together in group settings. And then when the time is right and marriage would be in the not too distant future, they can kind of start to pair off more and develop, you know, relationships as couples. Does that help? Okay.
So thinking of some of this latter conversation, industrial revolution, right of feminism, the lack of production in the home, And then thinking in conjunction with Proverbs 31 and the woman who is the who is in some ways like center of production in her home, or the home becomes the center of production wherein she does these things. Can you relate that to many of our homes that are not centers of production? And so what does proper femininity look like in a home that is not a center of production in the same way?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, the last time I did one of these conferences, I got that same question pretty much. I think a lot of people are thinking about that. One thing I would do is tell you to read C.R. Wiley's book. It's called Man of the House, and it is on this whole idea of a productive household. I mean, obviously, the book is written especially for men, but I think women could probably benefit from it too, just because he does explore some of these things that I've talked about, and he goes into maybe a little bit more detail. Some of Alan Carlson's work goes into some detail about what the pre-industrial household was like and how the Industrial Revolution changed that. It might give us some ideas. So, yeah, what would it mean for our households to become centers of production once again? That's a really hard question to answer in the modern world. I will say this. You know, if there's a silver lining to the coronavirus lockdowns and that kind of thing, it's that a lot of people sort of rediscovered home and home life and how to make home life work and even how to work out of your home. And there could be a lot of good things about that. It may be that our technology allows us to be more decentralized and to be more productive in our homes than we could be in the past. I mean, you're not going to bring modern manufacturing back into the home. I mean, obviously, that's not possible because it just, you know, what manufacturing is today, that's not going to happen. And you can do things on a small scale. I mean, you know, I know people who've got chickens and gardens and things like that, you know, even on a little suburban plot of ground. But, you know, to me, those are kind of really minor things that don't necessarily tackle the real problem. Another thing we could consider is how to make our homes, you know, places where we bring elderly parents instead of institutionalizing them. I mean, that's one that I know Wiley's talked about. You know, so I would say read his book and then try to apply some of the principles that he develops there to your own situation. I don't have great answers to that question, but I do think it's a great question. And I think it's one we ought to continue to work at, because I do think it's going to be one of those keys for us going forward. You know, Wiley, for example, in the book is kind of down on corporations, which, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with working in corporate America. I don't think corporate America is always a soul-deadening environment, although, I mean, I do agree with him that a lot of times it is. But, you know, obviously, you know, we talked about the smartphone and how terrible this thing is. At the same time, you know, most of us probably don't want to give them up or give up our cars or any other modern technological advancements. And all those things require, you know, basically corporate America or a kind of global, you know, corporatism. I don't think that we want to see all that just go away. But I do think we can ask, you know, what are some things, even some vocations that might be more household centric and more household friendly? And I certainly think women ought to be asking that question. You know, what kind of vocation could I pursue that I, you know, could combine or that would not interfere with, or that I could take a break from even for a number of years in order to go, you know, raise my children when they're young? What kind of career path or vocational path would be best, you know, in that kind of situation? I even think for some women, I think what we'll see eventually happen is some women decide that they want to be a wife and a mother and do that when they're young. And then after their kids are grown, go to college then and go, you know, kind of pursue a career of some sort when they're older and maybe their kids are out of the house, which if you get started early enough on your family, you can do. And then, you know, that may be another way of thinking about being a productive household. It doesn't all have to happen in the household. There are things you can do outside the household, but that serve your household. I don't know. There's a lot of things to think about there, a lot of different, you know, ways to go. But like I said, I think it's a great question, one we need to keep exploring.
All right. Well, let's thank you one more time. Oh,
yeah.
Another question.
Was there a question?
Okay. So considering when you talk about marriage and its influence, its circle of causality on the bonding and benefits it does to individuals, you know, it's basically function, the way it functions. Now, the way fornication works and it separates that bond, obviously, do you think adultery or fornication should push that boundary of, like, murder and stealing to be punished, considering our secular society? I mean, different states, they punish it. Others, they ignore it. Or even push to the fact that even countries
they believe that it is morally acceptable to commit fornication.
Mm-hmm.
And other countries, of course, they harshly and even punish it with death.
Mm-hmm.
And even pushes the fact where they punish one sex harder than the other. So I want to see your view on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's an interesting question and kind of, I guess, a theoretical question at this point, since I don't anticipate, you know, any of these things being, you know, brought up by the what looks to be the new presidential administration or anything like that. Yeah, so it's interesting. If you go back and you look at the Torah, you know, the Old Testament law, adultery was a crime punishable up, you know, by death, or at least up to death. I mean, that was the, you know, I'm not saying it had to always be punished by death, but I mean, that was a possibility at least. So think about that. Why would adultery be punishable by death? Well, the biggest reason is because God is so committed to the institution of marriage, he wants to protect it. And the greatest threat to the institution of marriage is adultery, and so God makes it a crime with very severe consequences. You could also, of course, look at that spiritually. You know, spiritual adultery, you know, is a form of apostasy, and so, you know, it's got to be dealt with, you know, that way. And of course, you know, even when adultery is not punished with death, it's still grounds for divorce, you know, because it's a form of covenant breaking. So there are all those things to keep in mind. And those are just, those laws are there because God wants to protect the institution of marriage. And actually, those laws were present in a lot of Western civilization for, you know, much of the last, you know, say 1500 years. I mean, there were laws, you know, I don't know universally, but you know, for example, there was a law in the state of Virginia, and I'm not advocating for this or saying this is how it should be. It was kind of the mentality that, you know, if a man, I forget, R.L. Dabney talks about this. So Dabney, you know, this could have been late 19th century, but there was a law in the state of Virginia on the books that if a man, you know, caught his wife in the act of adultery and killed the man she was with, he was not liable for anything. You know, it was just understood, you know, it was understandable why he did that, and so there's no crime that's been committed here. Again, I'm not advocating for that kind of thing, but I'm just saying, I mean, there's been a commitment through the history of Western civilization, when our civilization was perhaps stronger in a lot of ways, to protect the institution of marriage. Obviously, all of those laws are gone. I think if we really wanted to, and you asked about fornication as well. Fornication was not a crime in the Old Testament, but it was a sin. And I think that's, you know, probably wise. So, you know, it ought to be a sin that we certainly warn people about. And, you know, say if a couple was caught, you know, sleeping together before marriage in Old Covenant Israel, you know, basically the girl's father could decide what to do, you know, whether or not they should marry or not. And he'd have to, you know, he would be penal. I guess you could say it was a crime in the sense that he had to pay a penalty, but it wasn't punishable by death the way adultery was. So, I mean, again, that was just a way of trying to protect sexual purity and discourage sexual immorality and protect the institution of marriage. And I do think we ought to have laws that protect the institution of marriage. I would say if we wanted to do that in our culture, and again, I mean, any of these things are, I mean, our culture is so far gone in this area, I don't think you're going to see anything like this happen. But, you know, if there's any law that you could just snap your fingers and change, I think the no-fault divorce law, it actually started here in California with Ronald Reagan in what I think it was like 1969, was the first no-fault divorce law, you know, signed in the United States. I think it was 1969. And then it spread very quickly across the rest of the country. And a lot of this was actually Women's Lib kind of stuff, was pushing for these no-fault divorce laws. You know, that's one certainly that, I mean, you fundamentally change what marriage is if you say that people can opt out of it that easily, you know, with so little cause and with so little consequence. And that is what's happened. I mean, almost immediately after no-fault divorce laws went into effect, the divorce rate multiplied 10 times, you know, from about 5% to 50%. And it's kind of hovered between about 40 and 50%. The main reason the divorce rate's gone down a little bit in recent years is just because people aren't getting married. So not as many, you don't have as many marriages, so you don't have as many marriages breaking up. But that would be one thing I would really change. Of course, same-sex marriage makes a travesty, just makes a mockery of what the institution of marriage is. You can't have same-sex marriage. It's just an impossibility. God has defined what marriage is. It's built into the order of reality. It's woven into the fabric of reality, and it is what it is. And, you know, no Supreme Court ruling or law passed by Congress can change that. But it does make a mockery of the institution, and it makes a mockery of sexual chastity. And, you know, as much as we talk about overturning Roe v. Wade, I think overturning Obergefell ought to also be, you know, an ultimate goal that we have, even though obviously that's not going to happen anytime soon. So I hope that answered your question, just to some degree.
I think about, you know, the manhood perspective of leading in the home of various forms of entertainment, call it TV shows, movies, sports, arts, music, etc. You know, how far do we go down that path of not being legalistic, but yet not letting in our home certain things that could be, you know, something in a movie that portrays homosexuality, or, you know, sports this year, the big BLM movement, things like that. I'm trying to think of how do you ingest various forms of entertainment without taking it too far to where you exclude.
Right.
So how do I respond to that?
Yeah, as our culture gets more and more degraded and our entertainments become more and more degraded, it's, you know, you think, well, maybe the Amish are onto something. I mean, you know, it's easy to think, you know, it would be easier to just drop out altogether, you know, because then we don't have to make all these decisions. I mean, you know, for us parents, how much time do we spend looking up on, you know, like Plugged In or some other website, you know, what's in this or that movie to see whether or not it's okay? It's like it's kind of humiliating in the way that we have to do that. It's a frustrating waste of time, and yet we, you know, we feel like the only choices are either we just let all kinds of garbage, you know, into our lives, into our families' lives, into our kids' lives, or we just shut everything out and kind of cut ourselves off, and then you've got, you know, that creates problems of its own too, you know, because, you know, if you take that approach, you're going to have all kinds of, you know, you'll have different problems, but you'll still have problems with your kids. So you might solve one problem, but you create a new problem. So I don't know if that's the way either. I don't know any solution other than just continually being discerning, being vigilant. I mean, part of it is I would just say let's limit how much we watch stuff. I mean, let's pull the plug on some of these things. We don't have to watch every new movie that comes out. We don't have to watch every Netflix series that comes out. I mean, it's okay. You're going to live, you know, even if you haven't seen what you feel like all your friends have seen or that other people are talking about, what have you. So, you know, let's be okay with being a little bit out of step in that kind of way. But I don't know any other answer other than to just say we've got to continually practice discernment. We've got to find sources we trust that can help us determine what might be worth our time and investment and what's not. I think that I don't think boycotting is the answer in the sense that, you know, I don't think that's an answer that Scripture gives to us. Paul says we can't go out of the world. You know, we're going to do business with unbelievers. We're going to have, business engagements with unbelievers and that kind of thing. But I just think we have to be very, very discerning. And I think we have to be very, very careful. And I would say err on the side of caution and recognize that, you know, some people, some Christians and, you know, various ages and stages of life, this might differ, but some Christians will be more impervious to these kinds of influences than others. But there's a really good chance that your kids are easily influenced by what they watch and read and listen to. And you'd be, I think, very wise as a parent to be extremely careful and moderated and guarded in what you let into the home. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I would just be very, very careful about it. I wouldn't say no to everything, but, you know, I'd be real careful about what you say yes to.
Yeah.